Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. Before we begin today's exposition, I'd like to remind you about my new website, which is different from the radio website. It's called jimandrewsbooks.com, and there you will find all my books, including Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times, which combines biographical narrative and theological insight about suffering. Another book, Dispatches from the Front Lines, The Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry, is for pastors and lay leaders alike. The Finality of Jesus Christ, Exploding the Many Roads to God Myth, will help you understand and explain to others in this day of religious pluralism why Jesus Christ is the only way to God. A Life Worth Dying For will teach you the radical meaning of Christian excellence in a culture that thrives on moral mediocrity. Finally, Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road, will help you get your marriage back on track, or will help even one partner make the best of a bad situation. That's jimandrewsbooks.com. And now, let's continue our current study. We continue with our exposition of Genesis chapter 25. Here we come to the death of Abraham and a historical and literary transition to the account of Isaac and then Jacob and Esau. At some point after the death of Sarah, Abraham took another wife. Her name was Keturah. She was a concubine, according to 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 32. That was her status. In those days, concubines were secondary wives, not in the plan of God, but a custom that had become ingrained, that God tolerated for a time, but he did not create. As concubines, these so-called wives did not ordinarily possess a dowry. Their children did not have primary rights to inheritance. We find in verse 2 of Genesis 25 that Keturah bore Abraham 6 sons. She bore him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shuah, all perfectly forgettable names except Midian. The identification of these tribes is uncertain, although most seem to be a confederation located in the Syro-Arabian desert to the east of the Jordan River and also southeast of Canaan. All of these sons, in their turn, would be married, and they would amplify the biological progeny of Abraham in accordance with God's original promise. Now, what we're going to see through this chapter is the faithfulness of God. Remember, God is always the protagonist in these narratives. God's the main actor, in other words. And we're going to see God's faithfulness redundantly underscored and the election of God underscored time and time again. That is a biblical theme. That promise of God was slow at first, but after Isaac, God's promise really starts gaining a big head of steam. As we count it, God may be slow about fulfilling his promises, but in the end, his fulfillment is sure and abundant. In verses 3 and 4, we find a brief genealogy of the male offspring of Keturah. From what we know, these tribal chieftains appear to have scattered and settled southeast and east of Palestine, toward and perhaps in Arabia. Identifications are in most cases uncertain. That's why I'm not reading them. It's not that important. The really important thing is that after Isaac, the progeny of Abraham was very prolific, as promised by God. That's the thing we're to see here. The genealogy makes a statement that God is true to His word. He performs as advertised, but in His own time and in His own way. Now in verse 5 we read, "And Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac." As the miracle child, as a child born to a couple who were biologically no longer able to produce a biological child, a miracle in that sense, as a miracle child of God's promise, and according to God's choice or election, Abraham made Isaac his heir. God stipulated that. But while he was still living, Abraham did grant gifts to the sons of his concubines, Hagar and Keturah. He sent them away to the east to clear the field for Isaac. In that way, he reduced the opportunity for molestation by envious relatives. All of this in the spirit of good fences make good neighbors. In time, bitter hostilities would arise from some of these sources, the relatives of Hagar and Keturah. But this step, at this time, gave the chosen line, Isaac's line, space in the providence of God to get rooted and established. On Abraham's part, this was a wise act. On God's part, this was His plan. We'll read in verse 7 that after 175 years, Abraham finally passes. But as he promised in verse 8, Abraham breathed his last and died in ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life, was gathered to his people. That was God's promise. I don't mean Abraham's promise. Genesis 15:15. Again, the key note here, we miss a lot if we miss this point, is the faithfulness of God. What God promised, God will perform. And we just see that redundantly throughout these narratives. And the text adds to the promise in 15:15, "You will go to your ancestors in peace," and he was gathered to his people. Embedded in those words is perhaps the expectation of the afterlife on the part of Abraham. That expectation is specifically mentioned in Hebrews 11:9-11. The author to the Hebrews tells us that by faith Abraham made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. We, too, are pilgrims and aliens in a foreign country of this world. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with Abraham of the same promise. I'm still reading from Hebrews 11. "For he, Abraham, the inspired author of Hebrews tells us, was looking forward to a city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God." There we see New Testament confirmation. The faith of Abraham looked forward to life beyond the grave and a reunion with his believing ancestors. In verses 9 and 10, we see that both Isaac and Ishmael honored Abraham in his passing. They came together to inter him in the grave in the cave of Machpelah of the patriarchs, situated in a field near the familiar grove of Mamre. To that site, Abraham had gained clear and formal title. One small piece of land that belonged to him, not for living, but for death, after all of his wandering years in the promised land. There had to be something much more, and we know there would be. Well, in verse 11, Abraham has now moved off the stage of biblical history, and it came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived by Beer Lahai-Roi, meaning a well of the living one or the one who sees me. But the faithfulness of God to the promises that the Lord had made to Abraham continue. Now these promises and this faithfulness is manifested in his blessing on the child of promise, Isaac. Before narrating the story of Isaac, Moses, as usual, fronts his literary account with a genealogical updating of all the players. He starts with the remoter son, Ishmael, and his line, before focusing on Isaac and his two sons, Jacob and Esau. In verse 13, in the genealogical account of Ishmael's sons, the key point, again, is the faithfulness of God. I cannot accentuate that enough. God is faithful to his promises concerning Ishmael, promises he made to both Abraham and Hagar. Now, these are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names, in order of their birth. And then he ticks off 12 princes. God promised way back that Ishmael would become the father of 12 nations or tribal rulers, and right here they are cataloged. Ishmael lived 137 years. He was gathered to his people, verse 18. Another prophecy then fulfilled, indicating, according to the divine prediction, chapter 16, verse 12, that there would be animosity between the tribes of Ishmael and Israel. We read, they settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria. Notice this line, he settled in defiance of all of his relatives. If we go back to Genesis 16, verse 12, we'll see what that's all about. These lines are not insignificant. In 16, verse 12, we read concerning Ishmael, that he will be a wild ass of a man, his hand will be against everyone, everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all of his brother. Well, in chapter 25, we see this being fulfilled. Chapter 16 had predicted that there would be animosity between the tribes of Ishmael and Israel, and even among themselves, and that's been true of the Arab peoples descended from Ishmael to this very day. He settled in defiance of all of his relatives, verse 18. They hate the Jews, they hate Christians, the Shiites and the Sunnis hate each other. God does not make people like this, but God knows intimately all the people whom he creates. He knows the path they will take before they ever take it. He knows why they do what they do. He knows when and where they will do it. And he knows how they will rationalize or justify themselves. God knows all, and in this case, he told Abraham, well before the fact, so that by this evidence, recorded later by Moses, that we might know that he alone is God. In verse 19, the author, under the influence of the Holy Spirit, continues to develop his narrative, building it around accounts or generations of key families. That's the structure of Genesis. Most especially, Moses traces the elective hand of God in the unfolding generations. He brings us down to the family of Isaac, the child of promise, the special child that God promised Abraham and Sarah, as the one through whom God's promises to Abraham would be fulfilled. In this case, what is most important to Moses in his narrative is to trace the unfolding purpose and promises of God through Isaac and Jacob. But to facilitate that from a literary point of view, Moses needs first to introduce us to the birth of Jacob and Esau, and to explain to us the sovereign election of the younger, Jacob, as the promise holder, not on the basis of personal merit, but on the basis of divine choice. So Moses refrains from developing at length the story of Isaac until he had first introduced us to the twins of Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Esau. So we read in verse 20 that Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But all was not well. The children struggled together within her. She said, "If it is so, why then am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord told her, "Two nations are in your womb, Two peoples will be separated from your body. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. Like other godly women, verse 21, Sarah, later Hannah, later yet Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, Rebecca was for some time childless, and undoubtedly she was frustrated, I'm sure, out of her mind. And she did a lot of praying, we can infer from the text. Isaac did a lot of praying, and God finally answered their prayers when Rebecca became pregnant with twins. As if a precursor of the friction that would exist between Jacob and Esau and their descendants, there was a commotion in Rebecca's womb that baffled her. We can translate her question a little differently. The same idea. What's happening to me? She asked. Then she did what most of us believers know to do in situations. She went to inquire of the Lord. It seemed symbolically predictive of the later hostility between the Israelites and the Edomites, the descendants of Esau. Well, on that occasion, verse 23, the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. Now, we'll see all of this play out, because God's word is true, and will faithfully come about. Now, what the Lord told Rebecca was a major cultural contradiction. In that society, the oldest had the right of inheritance. That was a given. It was called the right of primogeniture. But God has the sovereign right to override cultural custom. The choice of God trumps the customs of the culture. God declared that the younger of the twins, the one to exit the womb last, would be the heir of the Abrahamic promises. That choice obviously had nothing to do with personal merit. It was announced before the births of Jacob and Esau. See Romans 9. And that choice of the younger over the older, technically older, in the case of twins, serves as a model of sovereign grace, sovereign election in salvation. God elects the heirs of salvation. None of us deserve salvation. Nobody does. Nobody is chosen by God on the basis that's going to be a good person. No, no. No human being deserves God's salvation. God said in Exodus, way up ahead in our Bibles, I will have mercy upon whom I will have mercy. I will show compassion to whom I sovereignly, is the idea, determined to have compassion. That is his choice. God elects the heirs of salvation, but the future of the two is about to show that there was nothing in the character of either son, Esau or Jacob, that initially commended them to the grace of God, least of all Esau. Esau, as we are about to see, was a profane man. In John Bunyan's Muckraker, we find the image of Esau, a man who never looked up. But Jacob, on the other hand, before a work of grace changed him, he was a conniver and a deceiver. Well, in verses 24 through 25, in her time, Rebecca gave birth to twin boys. Esau was distinctly ruddy or red-like, hence his other name, Edom, which means red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, we read. That's why he was named Esau. It means hairy. An unusual covering of baby fuzz called hypertrichosis, or that seems to be what it was. Esau must have been a strange-looking infant, looking something like a budding outdoorsman right out of the chute. On verse 26, when the twins emerged from the womb, Esau coming out first, Jacob was grasping the heel of Esau. It so happened that grasping the heel was, or at least became, a familiar Hebrew expression for one who deceives or supplants. Thus, the second twin was appropriately named Jacob, which means supplanter, can mean also deceiver. I believe the idea of supplanting is more to the point in the naming of Jacob rather than deceiving. Why? Because by the will of God, Jacob supplanted Esau at birth. But later, the name proves prophetic in terms of deceiver, because Jacob would, by deception, at his mother's instigation, we notice the apple not falling far from the tree, would supplant Esau as the recipient of his father's blessing, deceiving him in the process. We will see that this trait, still later in his dealings with his father-in-law Laban, in his long stay at Paddan Aram. So both of these ideas, supplanting and deceiving, are blended in the characterizations of Jacob. In other words, Jacob was not a model of virtue, any more than Esau. They were quite different. Personality, folks, is a given, but character is developed around the stem of personality. Over time, God, by grace, changes Jacob's conniving character. We're not there yet, long way from that. God turns Jacob into a stalwart man of God, and he still does that same sanctifying, purifying work in his saints today. But let us never forget that God does not save us. He does not save anyone because of what we are or were. God saves us by his own sovereign grace, with what we can become by his grace in mind. Though the case with Jacob was a special circumstance in the history of Revelation, involving a very special person in the progress of God's redemptive plan, I think, aside from that, it is often very interesting how in life early things prove very predictive of future things. Early things can sometimes be a kind of microcosm of the whole. Perhaps it is more common than we think, because my guess is that folks are not ordinarily paying that much attention in early things for future reference. But no question that all of this was providential and intentionally prophetic. I think sometimes of Aussie and I as a couple. We've often commented on it. Just as we were getting to know one another and becoming attracted to one another, long backstory, I was going to preach my first sermon when I was just 18 years old on a youth Sunday in our local church. Aussie had grown up in it. I had just moved there. Pastor asked me to preach. Because it was youth Sunday, they asked her to read the scriptures. Who would have ever guessed that on that Sunday, Jimmy Andrews and Aussie Barnett would be up there, her reading the scriptures, and I bringing the message, that the two of us would become a couple. And here we are, downrange, married tomorrow, as a matter of fact, as I'm recording, 61 years. Ironic, isn't it? Well, there's more of that than you might imagine. By the way, just as a side note, for any might want to know, Jacob in Hebrew is James in Greek, and we use it today. More on that note of irony, when I was 3 years of age, my parents noted that when their first pastor, they had just become new Christians, Joe B. Brown was preaching in Quinwood Baptist Church, mining town, no nursery in that day. Every Sunday, I would passionately emulate Pastor Brown from the pews. Interesting that that little three-year-old became a preacher himself. Always thought it was interesting that the doctor who delivered me had to cut my tongue loose. Many would say, much to the regret of people along the way. Well, those things are so very interesting, I think. We'll come back to that. We're not quite finished with this. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.